Lord, as we look at this second chunk of 2 Samuel chapter 15 and then keep digging our way through this book and looking at the ups and downs of the life of King David, this man that you chose, as we notice this from the book of Romans on Sunday, of the Jewish people, part of the blessing bestowed upon them. Of course, there were the promises. Of course, there was the glory. And again, there was the covenants and the covenant that you established with David. As we look at his life, he was just like us, imperfect. Just like us, a sinner. Just like us, a human being that recognized his need for his God. We're grateful, even as we look at, again, the historic narrative, these paragraphs and chapters of this man's life. I'm so grateful that I wasn't alive in his day. I'm so grateful that someone's not 2,000 years later reading a book about my life and my mistakes. We're grateful, though, that, Holy Spirit, you made sure to have these things written for us, that we can learn from them. We can gather as a church body on a Wednesday evening. The summer's just getting started, and just kind of set aside this time to learn, to grow, to find maturity in our Christian lives. And we come confessing we're just like David. We need more of you in our lives, and that's why we're here. As we set aside this time, would you speak to our hearts, speak to our minds, and any actions or activities or ambitions in our hearts and minds that need to find discipline from you, we just lay ourselves before you and ask for, again, you to speak. So thank you for your word. Thank you for the Bible. Thank you that we can be here. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so 2 Samuel chapter 15, as we were looking at kind of the opening chunk of Absalom's treason, and everything is just starting to happen, and we arrive in verse 13 of 2 Samuel chapter 15. This is where word is now getting to the king, the true king, King David, about what's happening. This is how he responds as he hears what Absalom is doing. Now a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." Everyone is going that direction. They're following after this man. And so David, and let's read a few verses here. David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom." Like, we need to get going right now. "Make haste," he says, "to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us." And notice this, and just a quick note, I want to keep reading here, but the note at the end of verse 14, it so speaks about David's shepherd's heart. Why? "Lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us," and what? "Strike the city with the edge of the sword." In other words, Absalom's beef is with me. The problem he has is with me. He's trying to take over my kingdom. But all the other innocent civilians, they don't need to die. They don't need to have the sword come after them. He's coming after me and everyone that's with me. So let's go. And I love that. You know, there's so many instances, and again, I was hoping to cover some more ground quickly tonight, but there's so many instances where we think, no, you got to stand and fight. Sometimes you don't. And sometimes you just need to leave the scene. You need to walk away from what's happening. And in this instance, he needed to leave with haste. So verse 15, "The king's servants said to the king, 'We are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands.'" They were submitting to him. "Then the king went out with all his household after him." This is interesting, and I don't honestly understand it. Verse 16, "But the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep the house." Maybe his faith was, we're going to return, and I hope the house is in good shape. I just don't understand it, honestly. And we'll see the repercussion from that decision later. Verse 17, "And the king went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts. Then all his servants passed before him, and all the Cherethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from," notice this, verse 18, "from Gath, they passed before the king." Where's Gath? It's in Philistine country. These people are from that city, and they're following King David. Notice verse 19, Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why are you all, this is so fascinating, why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place, from Gath." In fact, verse 20, "You came only yesterday." Like, you have to laugh at this. Like, your timing is terrible, man. Like, I'm so sorry. Like, you got here yesterday. Is this his first full day on the job? I have no idea. I'm like, "Hey, welcome. Good to have you here. By the way, my son's trying to kill me, so I would encourage you maybe just go home. You don't have to." And just sorry about that. And he says, "Should I make you wander up and down with us today since I go, I know not where? Return and take your brethren back. Mercy and truth be with you." And just, you don't need to be here. You're welcome to go. But, verse 21, Ittai answered the king and said, "As the Lord lives, as Yahweh lives, and as my Lord the king lives, as my Adonai the king lives, surely in whatever place my Lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also your servant will be." This is a great man here. So David said to Ittai, verse 22, "Go and cross over." Then Ittai the Gittite and all his men and all the little ones who are with him crossed over. And so they're crossing, as we'll see here in verse 23, the Kidron, the brook Kidron. This is in the Kidron Valley there. And of course, if you've been to Israel and you've been just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, you have to go there and see this. But it's not this great colossal valley. It's almost like this cute little, not even a ravine. You know, it's like someone has to point out, this is the brook Kidron there, this little bubbly brook, and this is the Kidron Valley. Like that? It's not that impressive. But David, he gets to the outskirts and he's just waiting to make sure everyone is there. He's a great leader in that regard. And Ittai arrives and like, "Man, you should just go ahead and go home." He says, "No, we're going to stay with you." And so he crosses over. And then verse 23, "All the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over towards the way of the wilderness." And then on it would go in that direction. They're going east from there. And Ittai there, he's a person of interest to me. Again, this is, I don't know, his first full day on the job. It's his second day on the job. And he signed to work. He signed up to work for the king. And that was what he was going to do. And I love the determination in his heart. Like, this is what's happening right now. And I love that. And again, we notice some things in the last week or two concerning people's hearts towards the king and as they listen to the king, and the application should come quickly to us. And I don't want to find silly over spiritualized parallels, but at the same time, how do we follow our king Jesus? Do we follow him when things are going great? Well, I hope so, right? Things are going great. Nah, I don't know if I want to do this. Of course we want to follow him when things are great, but how about when things in life aren't so great? How about if we can say it, sometimes life just stinks. And is it at that point where we say, I don't know if I want to keep doing this. I don't know if it's really, how about this? And maybe we never quite vocalize it, but maybe it's vocalized in our hearts and probably in our minds. Do we say this? I don't know if it's worth it. I don't know if I can keep doing this. Lord, I thought I wanted to follow you, but with what's happening in my life, I don't know if it's just worth my time, my energy, my investment of who I am for you. It's always worth it. It's always worth it. Yeah, but things stink. What difference does that make? We're just passing through this side of eternity. If my Jesus went to the cross for me, why would I not follow him if things get a little bit bumpy along the way? Ittai is like, I came to serve you. So if we're fleeing Jerusalem, that doesn't change the fact. You are still the king. I love that. Such a great man. And he's a, verse 19, a foreigner from Gath. From Philistine countries? I don't care. David's my guy. Keep going. Verse 24, there was Zadok or Tzadok also, and all the Levites with him. And they were bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God because David had brought it finally back to Jerusalem. He had set up the sanctuary there. Bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God. And Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. And then verse 25, the king said to Tzadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, and please notice that there in verse 25, this kind of comment you'll see throughout the next few chapters. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, we're going to see the heart of David, like whatever God wants to do. If he wants to bless, great. If this is what is going to happen to me at this point, okay. But if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. But if he says thus, verse 26, I have no delight in you. If that's what the Lord says of me, I have no delight in David. Well, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. The Lord also said to Zadok and the priest, are you not a seer or a prophet? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, or Yonatan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. And therefore, verse 29, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. This is interesting because if you remember during the times of Eli, and the whole incident's like, we're going to battle, and what did they try to do with the ark? Well, let's bring it to battle with us. Almost like, if you remember this from 1 Samuel, an Old Testament equivalent of a lucky rabbit's foot kind of thing. Like, this is a good luck charm. Look, we've got the Lord with us. The Lord is not in that box, because the Lord's not in any box. And of course, what happened with the ark, you remember the story. Like, they lose the thing. And David at this point, I don't need the ark. The ark is not the Lord. The Lord is the Lord. And if he's going to bless, whether the ark is here or with me or not, but it should be where it belongs, in the sanctuary. And I like that. David would trust the Lord and keep the things of God in the right place and do as best he could the things of God the right way. I also love this further because, did you catch that in verse 28 as he tells them, just go home, your sons and everything, go home. I'll wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. David's no dummy. Like, these guys could be his eyes and ears. Like, no, how about if you guys just stay in Jerusalem because Absalom's coming to town and he's really going to set up shop and he's proclaimed himself in Hebron, the old capital, that he's going to be the king. And so, yeah, actually, if you guys can stay there and occasionally visit me out on the plain of the wilderness and just tell me what's happening, that would be so much better. He's no dummy. I love this. There's practicality to this too. So they remained there. In verse 30, David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up. And he had his head covered and went barefoot. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went up. So you go down from Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, Mount Moriah, into the Kidron Valley, and then up the ascent there to the Mount of Olives, and then kind of it breaks off into the wilderness towards Jericho, to the kind of the northeast, and then the wilderness to kind of the east and southeast. Did you catch that he's weeping there? He's barefoot, head covered. It's just in mourning kind of thing. And someone, verse 31, told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, oh Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. We're going to discover why he says that in chapter 16. But this had, and Ahithophel being there for Absalom, had real potential to be a real issue. But fascinating again, David's weeping. He's weeping. And in the next verse, notice what also happens. Verse 32, it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshipped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. But don't miss that. He worships, doesn't he? Now, weeping and worship don't always go hand in hand. I mean, let's just say it. I don't even have to say it, but let's just say it. Some people are super emotional and some aren't. Some people are like, they wear their emotions on their sleeves and everything's just an emotional kind of a thing. And other people are like, are you okay? I'm absolutely fine. Are you okay, Jeremy? Like, oh no, I'm great right now. You seem really bored. No, I'm just as excited as, like, this is the best day of my life. Right? Like, my wife's laughing because, yeah, ask her sometime when she told me when she was pregnant with Ian, our firstborn, like, I'm pregnant. And I think I said, cool, that's amazing. Like, and that was the height of, like, exuberance. You know, like, wow, that's amazing. Sweet. Like, so some people are just, talk to her later, but like, some people are way more emotional. And, you know, back in the, some of you guys remember this, back in the old building, you know, kind of every other row of chairs, we had like boxes of tissues. And like, you know, just in case, there's a lot of allergies around here, I get that, but it's, you know, just in case people got teary or whatever. And I didn't really feel the need for that. So when we kind of used up the tissues, I just didn't keep adding tissue boxes to the place. And one of the gals that used to be part of the church said, well, we need to, you know, get the tissues. I'm like, why? Well, because sometimes people get emotional during worship. Sure. But that doesn't mean that worship has to be inherently emotional. And if you don't have emotion, that doesn't mean that you're somehow not worshiping. Some people are just more so that way. Read through the Psalms sometime. David, that great warrior. I mean, he was a tender guy. He cried a lot. And so, will the two go hand in hand? Not necessarily. For some people, yes. But if we're relying on our emotions to prove that we're worshiping, we're now dependent on kind of a, it's not necessarily a fleshly thing like a carnal, sinful, bad thing, but just a base physical kind of part of our being. So, well, I just don't get, you know, a lot of emotion from it. Okay. And oh, by the way, and David worships? Worship's not about you anyways. It's not about how we feel about it. It's honoring the Lord. And I love that he pauses there to worship. And again, his weeping, though, you can't miss it. He had real reason and real reasons to weep. His own sin that had caused so much of this, and his almost absentee fatherhood in his own life towards his kids, his family, and the predicament of all this. And of course, his son Amnon that was murdered, and Absalom that's now trying to take over the kingdom from dad. Like, that would do it. And his daughter that had been raped. His friends, I mean, he's just now hearing, this is important, I mentioned about Ahithophel. His dear friend has turned on him. In fact, you can hold your place here, and you can turn to this if you'd like, but Psalm 6, there's a few psalms that seem to, and I'll come back to another one here. Yeah, I'll come back to another psalm. Psalm 6, it's likely that this is connected to this instance in his life. It's a psalm of David. Give ear to my... Oh, that's verse 5. Psalm 5, excuse me. Psalm 6. It's to the chief musician with stringed instruments on an 8-stringed harp. It's a psalm of David. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your hot displeasure. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are troubled. My soul also is greatly troubled. But you, O Lord, how long? Return, O Lord, deliver me. O, save me for your mercy's sake. For in death there is no remembrance of you. In the grave, who will give you thanks? I am weary with my groaning. All night I make my bed swim. Picturesque language of his tears. I drench my couch with my tears. My eye wastes away because of grief. It grows old because of my enemies, which were many, of course, at that point. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity. For the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. Let all my enemies be ashamed and greatly troubled. Let them turn back and be ashamed suddenly. And since we're here, you can just flip back to Psalm 3. You'll notice if you're there, I'm reading from the New King James, and this is Holman Publishers that happened to put this Bible together. But in italics, it says, the Lord helps his troubled people. And you might have a little title and you might not, but it's in italics. That means it's not in the original text. Like, we understand that. That's just there to help us see what we're about to read. But what's not in italics is the next part, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. When did David write that? This time in his life. And notice what he says, Lord, how they have increased who troubled me. And no wonder again that he's weeping. Many are they who rise up against me. And why is it many? Because Absalom had stolen the hearts of the people of the country. Many are they who save me. There is no help for him in God. Selah. Kind of think on that. But you, O Lord, and think about that contrast. Everyone is against me, but you. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. Selah. I love this, verse 5. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. And I love verse 5 because how do you do with that? Like everything's against you. Is it like, all right, well, I'm tired. I guess it's just time to go to sleep now. Or is this the first thing you think about in the morning and the last thing you think about and it keeps you up all night? And David, like, well, I'm tired from running for my life. My son's trying to kill me, and I guess it's just time to call it night. Everybody okay? We're done now. Let's sleep. Why? Because he knew the Lord is with him. He says, arise, O Lord, in verse 7. Save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. He just, Lord, would you punch him in the face for me? In holy glory, however that works. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing, is upon your people, Selah. And on and on, there's other psalms in that vein, but there's so much of this, and we'll see it in time permitting, this David's trusted friend, Ahithophel, had turned on him. And again, all these things that would cause him to weep, that would be brokenhearted over this whole entire predicament. So he worships the Lord back here, 2 Samuel 15. And Hushai arrives there. Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head, verse 32. Verse 33, David said to him, if you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant, and then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Like, listen, man, it's nice that you want to be here, but you're going to be a burden, and time permitting, we'll come back to that concept. You're going to be a burden to me. Really, what would be amazing if you could go back into the city, and if you can just tell Absalom, I used to work for your dad, and you, sir, are now the king, and so since you're the king, I'm now going to work for you. And here's Ahithophel, and everyone knows this guy with his brilliant counsel, and you can defeat his counsel, that would be way better than what you're doing and trying to run with me. And oh, by the way, verse 35, do you not also have Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? You're not going to be alone in this. Therefore, it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you've got that inside track, you shall tell to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Indeed, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send me everything you hear. He's no dummy. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Now, as we continue through this chapter, chapter 16 of David's life, and this overarching chapter of his life, we run into several individuals who play key roles in all of this. And, of course, they provide great examples along the way. And again, I appreciate how the Bible works, because some examples are great and we like Ittai, like, man, I want to be like that guy. What a great guy. And other examples, like, you do not want to be like that individual. And we'll see some of that here. So chapter 16, verse 1, when David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And of course, we met him back in chapter 9, I believe. Do I have that right? Yeah, chapter 9 is where we first meet Ziba. So he brings all this food. And chapter 16, verse 2, the king said to Ziba, what do you mean to do with these? So Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink. It's a long journey. We just want to help you with this. And then the king said, and where is your master's son? This is, of course, referencing Mephibosheth. And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. My father? Who is he referencing? Saul, ultimately. It's going to come back to this dynastic line, which should be mine. Mephibosheth, man. So the king said to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I humbly bow before you that I may find favor in your sight, my lord, O king. If David's weeping before to get this news about Mephibosheth, and if you remember Mephibosheth, and I spent probably the entire week when we got to chapter 9 dealing with that, remember Mephibosheth, that David said, you're going to eat at my table like one of the king's sons. And the grace that he bestowed upon this man, he searched for him. Well, what we don't know at this point in 2 Samuel is also what King David doesn't know. Ziba is lying. Like, oh, well, that stinks. Yeah, it stinks. But David doesn't know this yet. And there's a couple lessons even with this, and just the example of this man, Ziba, who, like, that's nice that he's bringing all this stuff, right? And he also brings this bad message about Mephibosheth. Like, what's going on? Where's Mephibosheth? And he decided to stay because he's hoping that the kingdom is going to be restored to him. It's hard to know who to trust sometimes, isn't it? Let's just say it. And I find this, the older I am with Jesus, the longer I walk with him, it's almost shocking. Like, wait, oh, that's right. I forgot. People sometimes lie, right? And like, the more you're a Christian, like, oh, everyone tells the truth. Like, okay, so actually they don't, right? That's not how the world works. And especially, and I don't know why I keep going back to this, but it's an election year, and certainly our politicians would never lie to us, right? That's a cute thought. Just enjoy that as long as you want to enjoy that. So we can't control other people, but we can control ourselves. And I think there's a simple lesson in that. Secondly, just a simple lesson looking at this man Ziba, his heart must have just been, again, so much with the brokenness that he was already carrying and Ahithophel and his own son and all the rest, and now Mephibosheth. All that he had done for Mephibosheth, that Mephibosheth would turn against King David. And you just wonder, and we're not really told here, but, you know, again, just even the tone of voice from David there in verse 4, it's not given to us. As he says to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. I don't think it's an upbeat kind of a, you know, major key, kind of a happy sounding, just take it. I think it's just the weight of all these things. And at what point is there a breaking point for you? But for David, he's still somehow trusting the Lord in this. Well, the next individual provides another example. Notice verse 5. Now, when King David came to Baharim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, or Shimei, the house of Gera, even the son of Gera, coming from there, and he came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. So this major procession of people leaving town, and here's this guy, Shimei, and he's just throwing rocks and cursing at the king. Also, Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. Like, you're a man of blood, you're a man of bloodshed, and you're just this, essentially, this worthless man. And maybe your translations render rogue just a worthless man. Like, you're a nobody. You're just a terrible individual. He continues in verse 8, the Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul. So he's blaming David for everything that's happening to David, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you are a bloodthirsty man. Like, this is your fault, what you did to King Saul. I'm like, wait a minute, time out. What had David done to King Saul? Nothing that this man's describing. And as with Ziba, oh, was it Mark Twain that said this? I'm sure I'm paraphrasing it, but it's something like, a lie travels halfway around the world before truth puts its shoes on. Something like that. And like whatever this man believed, he really believed it about David, but he was wrong about it. He's yelling and insulting the king, throwing rocks at him. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, verse 9, I wonder what his tone was, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? And I love his loyalty. Please let me go over and take off his head. I'm pretty sure I can handle this quickly. I can alleviate the issue here, O king. But the king said, verse 10, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and all his servants, see how my son who came from my own body seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite, let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. Did David really believe this? Maybe. Again, this is, as we saw in chapter 15, this is David, I'm leaving it all in the Lord's hands. If I deserve this, then why would anyone stop what's coming to me if I deserve it? If I don't, we'll deal with that at another time. And of course, he does. But this man, well, keep reading and then we'll look at this man, Shimei, a little bit. He goes on there, verse 12. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. As David and his men went along the road, Shimei, he went along the hillside opposite him, cursed as he went, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust, which is exactly what you and your family and all these families of all these people want, as you're just, because you want this to be like a, as we read it in a short little paragraph there, like there's like 20 seconds of it, and then it's done. Is this 2 hours of it? Maybe. And if you've been there, like there's rocks everywhere. It's not like there's a shortage of rocks. This guy's not going to run out of rocks to throw at this whole procession of people. His arm probably would have been tired before this whole thing. Now the king and all the people who were with him became weary. So they refreshed themselves there. They finally got to a place to get away from this. But Shimei, he falls into several categories of example. There's always the sort of people, and this isn't necessarily like a spiritual lesson, but it's helpful to just get our heads around a little bit. There's plenty of people who resort to nothing but name calling. Remember, have that kind of people, like you really like to have a conversation, like, can we talk about this? How about a cup of coffee? Like, let's talk about it. Like, and just the only response they have is name calling. And you see this all over our society today. Like, we're really good at quick on the draw with our label guns. Like, you are this label printed, place that on them, and that's all there. And we just label people and name call, and I don't think we should be good at that. This man was just the name calling kind of person. And he's also the kind of person, and again, this isn't a uniquely spiritual thing, but he blames others for perceived wrongs. Everything that happened to Saul, it's your fault. Everything that happened with his kingdom, it's on you. And everything that's now happening to you from your son Absalom, it's because of what you did to my father or grandfather, the king. He's blaming others for this instead of getting the facts. And how about this? And this is a uniquely Christian thing. Has this refusal to bless others, including one's enemy? Pretty sure in New Testament, our Savior would call us to bless those that curse us. And I'm pretty sure any enemies that we should have would be them making us their enemy rather than us making them. Like, it should start somewhere else. And we should pray for those that curse us. And we shouldn't be the kind of people that's resorting to name calling and blaming and refusing to bless others. And again, Abishai, can I take his head off? No, stop it. And again, David, his example here. He trusts the Lord. Maybe this is from God. It's not as, and this is the thing for me, like, did David believe this? I don't think he really did, but at the same time, it's not as though David believed himself to be some kind of innocent man, right? He knew his own ways. He knew his own heart. He knew his own actions, and this is why in chapter 15 he was probably weeping in the first place. So this is just another kind of set of obstacles coming his way. Then, okay, I guess that's the Lord. Meanwhile, verse 15, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, they came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. This friend of the king's, King David's, is there with Absalom. So it was when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king." And so Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" He repeats this because that's what Hushai was. I mean, notice the very end of chapter 15, verse 37. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city. And Absalom knew this. Everybody knew that's what this guy is. Just like everyone would have known that Ahithophel would have been David's kind of prime counselor, his main guy. And Hushai was fine there for advice and whatnot, but his main role was to be the king's friend. So why did you not go with your friend? Verse 18, Hushai said to Absalom, "No, but whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be, and with him I will remain. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son, of the king's son? As I have served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence." I don't love this from Hushai, because how much of this is not true? How much of it is actually not true, though? Does he really answer the question? In verse 18, "No, but whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, I'll be that guy's guy." I'm not saying that the Lord chose you, Absalom. So he's actually chose David, so I'm going to be loyal to David. So there's just a little bit of... So I'm not crazy about this, but of course, what did we learn from chapter 15, verse 34? That he might defeat the counsel of Ahithophel, David said, for me. And so this is... this opportunity here for Hushai to protect King David by defeating Ahithophel's counsel. And again, specifically in this, everyone has a part to play. And what is the general context of what's happening? This is a revolt. This is a revolution. This is his son usurping the kingdom. It's a time of war, if I can put it in the simplest of terms. And what would his part be in this time of war? Well, man, I need you to just... destroy, defeat Ahithophel's counsel. Well, speaking of his counsel, verse 20, "Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, 'Give advice as to what we should do.'" So they're in the city. What should we do now? "And Ahithophel said to Absalom, 'Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father, and then the hands of all who are with you will be strong.'" In a word, this is obviously despicable. There's a couple things about this as well, though. If you remember back in chapter 12, and you can turn back a couple chapters, chapter 12, after David's sin with Bathsheba and, of course, Uriah, Nathan the prophet arises and he visits David. He gives this parable to the king about the little lamb and everything. And then he begins to just give the repercussions to David. Verse 9 in chapter 12, 2 Samuel. "Why have you despised the commandments or the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife. And you have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house," as we're seeing in David's life at this point, "because you have despised me," this is the Lord speaking, "and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord," verse 11, "behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. Verse 12, for you did this secretly, but I'll do this thing before all Israel, before the sun." This is terrible, but there's repercussions that are happening from David. Now, as for Absalom, back here in chapter 16, he takes the counsel of Ahithophel. He does this. And again, it's despicable, and there's no way around this. Like, political, whether there's political reasons for this, getting back at his dad, or whatever this is, again, if we're going to put it into the singular word, and we must, it's obviously still rape. And didn't Absalom have Amnon, his brother, killed because of rape? And the 10 concubines that David left, so check your math there, this is 10 times that. And he killed Amnon, his half-brother, for that action. And he's doing the exact same thing? Is this power that's going to his head? Is it one of those things that it's okay for me, but it's not okay for others? This is a terrible situation, and Absalom is terrible. This terrible young man, terrible individual. One of the other ways that's terrible about him, while David sought God, Absalom looked to human wisdom and human experience only. Again, this is just secular, kind of the way he's thinking. And this is Ahithophel. This is another fascinating snippet from one of the Psalms. This would be Psalm 41 and verse 9. Definitely, if you're a note taker, put pen to paper for that. Psalm 41, verse 9, where David says, "Even my own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me." We don't know directly if that is speaking about Ahithophel, but it sure seems like it. He's just working against King David. Verse 23, here's why David, back in chapter 15, I mentioned, when he hears that Ahithophel is going with Absalom, like he's so distraught over this because of the information we have here. Chapter 16, verse 23, "Now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. And so was the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and Absalom." It's kind of, how do we say this in secular terms? You know, you can take it to the bank, or it's Bible, right? When someone says it's Bible, what he says, man, you have to go along with this because it's just brilliant. And this is why, and I'm pausing here, because at the end of chapter 15, David says to Hushai, what? Go back to Jerusalem. Thanks for wanting to come with me, but go back. And this is why that was so critical. And this is why David asked him to return to Jerusalem, because in chapter 15, what was David's main point for sending Hushai back to Jerusalem? Obviously, we're told so that he might defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. But he says there, in verse 33 of chapter 15, "If you go on with me, then you'll become a burden to me." That's interesting that he says that. We're told in 1 Chronicles chapter 27 that Ahithophel was King David's counselor, and Hushai was King David's friend, as we find repeated here in these chapters in 2 Samuel 15 and 2 Samuel chapter 16 about Hushai. I was like, okay, Jeremy, so what? Like, you're not helping me here. So I'm asking this, so then why does David send Hushai back to Jerusalem? Again, okay, fine, it seems like he's going to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. That's the hope. But wouldn't it be nice if he has a close friend with him while he's in exile? Like, wouldn't that be helpful? Wouldn't you like to have that with you? But again, he says in chapter 15, I'm repeating this, verse 13, "You'll become a burden to me." And that simply means, the Hebrew behind burden is simply something essentially that someone would have to carry. What's the point? And this is why I said this just a few minutes ago. This is why he was so critical, and this is why he asked him to return. Did David know this of Hushai? Did everyone know this about Hushai? Why does he say you're going to be a burden? Did he have some sort of physical condition? And we don't know. But this is the only person to whom or of whom he said, "You're going to be a burden to me." You ever have that when you're traveling in a group? Like, you're only as fast as the slowest person kind of thing? Like, come on, keep up, everybody. And you know, it's like everyone's talking about that one person kind of like, come on, let's go. Can someone help Hushai? This is what it would have been. So did he have some sort of physical condition, some issue, some disorder or disability? Again, we don't know, but since he apparently would not have been able to keep up while David was on the run, I'm smiling because whatever his physical limitation was, or whatever his physical limitations were, that's exactly what allowed him to be in Absalom's presence. You're not going to be able to keep up. So man, you know it would be amazing if you could stay in Jerusalem as my friend, and I need you to defeat Ahithophel's counsel, because Ahithophel, his words are like the oracles of God. Like, everyone listens to that guy, and he's a brilliant strategist. I am in trouble if he tells Absalom what to do. Chapter 17, and we won't get into the whole chapter tonight. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will rise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid. And all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike only the king, and then I will bring back all the people to you. When all return except the man whom you seek, all the people will be at peace." And the saying pleased Absalom and the elders of Israel. So here's the rest of Ahithophel's counsel for Absalom. What was he saying there in verses 1 through 3, basically? And everyone says, okay, sounds good. It's, let's go. Let's go right now. Let's end this thing immediately. I will be able to get in there. We're going to kill the king. And it's over. And everyone will just come home. But let's do that. It's actually really brilliant advice. Let's just go. Then, since Hushai just so happened to be there, verse 5, then Absalom said, "Now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he says too." Really interesting. So, when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, "Ahithophel has spoken in this manner," verses 1 through 3, "and shall we do as he says? If not, speak up." And it's almost like a test here from Absalom to Hushai to see what he's going to do, what he's going to say. So Hushai said to Absalom, "The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time." Hushai in the right place. Now notice there in verse 7, he has to thwart Ahithophel's advice, but sound like he's really supporting Absalom, right? He can't say, no, he can't say this. Like, just let David go. He's never going to be a problem to you again. He's fine. He can't say that. And it's interesting there in verse 7, the word time seems to, at least to me, it seems to be the key. And maybe your translation renders it differently. Chapter 17 and verse 7, "The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time." I think some of your translations might say, "This time his advice is not good." And it's fine either way, or it's almost, you can maybe render it a third way. At this time, his advice is not good. Essentially, his advice is always great. I mean, we all know Ahithophel's advice is always great, but this is not the right time for that maneuver. It's not the right time for what he's describing. Again, because if he just says, let him go, then everyone's going to know he's working for King David. So notice that he continues. He doesn't leave any room here for debate or discussion. And if you would, just kind of as you're glancing over the text here, would you notice the breadth, the length of his advice? This is verses 8 through 13. Check my math there. That's 6 verses. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 6 verses. Compare that to Ahithophel, verses 1, 2, and 3. And again, I'm reading from the New King James. Ahithophel's advice, if I counted this correctly, is 73 words. And basically, Hushai's advice is at least double that. Ahithophel is saying, notice this in verses 1 through 3. I want to compare the advice that both of them gives. He says in verse 1, "Let me choose these 12,000 men." Notice the second part of verse 1. He says, "I will arise." In verse 2, he says, "I will come upon him while he's weary and weak. I will strike only the king." In verse 3, "I'll bring back the people." It's short. It's sweet. It's a great strategy. But it's not really about Absalom. Like, it doesn't make Absalom look good, but it's the right thing to do. Notice another contrast from Hushai. Skip all the way down to verse 11. He says, "Therefore I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan, which is in the far north, to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person." I think you can see what he's doing. He's like trying to prop up the king here a little bit. Like, you need to be the man to do this. Ahithophel, his advice is not good at this time. His advice is always great, but this is actually what should happen is you got to go in person. You're the king. It's your fight. And as we'll see here in a few minutes, as we just kind of quickly read through what he says, he repeats words and phrases like all Israel. And he uses the word we on several occasions. Where Ahithophel in verses 1, 2, and 3, but I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. But he says we as if he's trying to say, look, you're the king and we are all united under the Absalom banner. So whatever you, man, we're going to follow. And if you go out to battle, oh, king, that would be amazing. Now here's the last thing to notice. I'm just going to read through his speech in a minute. But the word pictures that he employs here, he's just filled with them. He's painting pictures and he's portraying scenes, scenarios, discussions. Like he's putting words almost like you could imagine King David's about to say this. And this speech, don't miss it. Like why aren't we highlighting a speech? This speech saves David's life. If Ahithophel's advice, verses 1, 2, and 3 had been followed, I mean, the Lord's the Lord, so the Lord would have protected David. I don't want to say but the advice was correct from Ahithophel. And this speech is what David understood. You have to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. So again, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time, says Hushai. For, said Hushai, verse 8, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds. What a picture that is. And then he gives a picture like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Just a mama bear like that in any culture. Everyone knows like that's bad news, right? In the field, like an open field. And your father is a man of war and he will not camp with his people. So now he's just imagining like what the geographic kind of outlook will be and the terrain will be. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit. You can picture that. Or in some other place. And it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say, this is what people are going to say, O king. There is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. That's what's going to happen if they start to lose. And then, not only that, verse 10, and even he who is valiant, and notice the word picture, whose heart is like the heart of a lion. Even that guy, what's going to happen? His heart will melt completely. What a word picture is that? Why? For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore, verse 11, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, just across the entire nation, north to south, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, just more than can be counted. And that you go in battle in person. And so we will come upon him in some place where he may be found. And we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be so much as one left. Moreover, verse 13, if he is withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there. That's the speech. And so Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. And this is now commentary in verse 14. Why? For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. This is amazing here. Just wrap it up with this. There's power in our words. What we say, how we say things, for good and for evil. And I'm so fascinated by this whole thing, all the way from chapter 15 to here, with Hushai in particular. He wants to go with David. He's volunteering. Like, look, man, you're going to be a burden to us. I don't know what that means other than you're going to slow us down. That's what I imagine he's saying. So really what would be great is if you can just stay in Jerusalem and you can be my friend by giving false advice to Absalom so that, as he says, you can defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. That's the fight that I need you to fight. I don't need you out here on the run with us. That the Lord places the right people in the right place at the right time to say the right thing to the person who needs to hear it. And he placed this man Hushai there intentionally. And again, we're told here, Ahithophel's advice was good. And it was likely much better. But the Lord had put this all in place. And Hushai's strategy was stop Ahithophel's plan. And plan, do we have a plan? No. His plan. And then obviously buy David some time. Ahithophel saying, we need to go tonight. I think Hushai knew, it's going to take some time to get the whole nation ready to go. So let's do that. Let's get everybody and you go into battle. You just got to get David some time. We'll look at this the next time we get into 2 Samuel. Because the word has to get out to King David on what the plan is here. There you go. Lots of great examples. Lots of tough examples. Power in words. Find good examples and live by them. Thanks for being here. See you guys.